Well, hello and welcome to what is a Wednesday webcast with me, Al Coates. Scott is still under doctor's orders that he's not allowed to come on in case the blood pressure goes too high. Such is the nature of our Wednesday webcasts. However, with me today, I have got Jane Griffiths, who is I'll let you introduce yourself, Jane. We're going to be talking about child to parent violence. What we're talking about, how we define it. Well, that's where we're going to start. This is a terrible introduction. I should work.
Yeah, you promised me. You promised me a glamorous introduction, Al. I'm a bit, you know. Can we start again?
I've let you down.
No, it's okay. So, Jane,
all singing and dancing.
No, don't big me up too much because then I will let you down. So, hello, I'm Jane Griffiths. I'm the founder, lead director for CAPA First Response, which is CAPA First Response. We're a company interest, we're a community interest company, which means we're non-for-profit, we're not charity, but we're non-for-profit. And we support families, the whole family. So this is siblings, grandparents, extended family, parents, children up until the age of 25, if there's a secondary diagnosis or a learning need. And we do that work remotely. We do it either via phone or webmail or text, sometimes WhatsApp, all sorts of different things. And we work with families throughout the UK and abroad. And it's really kind of trying to plug a gap. It was started, Al, because I've worked in this field with familial violence for 20 odd years. And specifically with child to parent abuse for just over 10 years now. And what struck me is it's a real postcode lottery, what's available and where it's available. So I really wanted to sort of set up something that it doesn't matter where you are, you can get support.
So you talk there a little bit about you starting in sort of familial violence, not familiar violence, both. it's Wednesday night, you know, we're all a bit, it's been a long day at work. Where did the kind of this then sort of slip into something that was very much more focused on the behaviour of children and adolescents?
Well, yeah, I personally have always had a children and young person's background in my work. I'm always at the centre of the work I do is children and young people. Certainly when it comes to domestic violence and abuse, I was really passionate about young people and children having a voice. And I worked for a charity called Rise down in Brighton and a part of a team who helped put together the first evidence-based toolkit called Break for Change. And it was something that was a European evidence-based program. And I became involved in that in the really early days of first conferences and putting together the first couple of groups and kind of really piqued my interest because it was the first also concurrent group that worked with both the parent or caregiver and child or young person who was using the behaviour that was considered abusive or violent. And it gave a real sort of, I was really passionate about it because of the voice it gave the young people and the fact that it wasn't there to blame young people. It was all about joint responsibility and understanding the root causes behind the behaviour and not coming in from an approach that was really punitive. And that really appealed to me. Mm-hmm. So I worked on that programme for a long time, developed a training programme, and we delivered that programme up and down the UK and actually out in Australia. I didn't get to go to Australia, sadly, but, you know, we did a lot of calls. And, you know, it became really embedded. And that's from working on that program and traveling around and talking to, you know, families and practitioners about the issue. That's where I realized about the gap. So that's kind of how I got into it, so to speak, and how I first became familiar with it. And God, that was probably 2000. Where are we? Yeah, probably 2010, right? Sort of where people were starting to discuss it for the first time, where people were starting to think about, okay, there's something going on. And even back then, 10 years ago, we were saying, oh, the press is covering this so much more than they ever used to. Oh my gosh, people are going to know that this is an issue. It's 12 years ago. And we're still saying that, you know, which is just, it's fascinating.
I mean, it still feels very much like an underground issue that occasionally tips above the surface. And what I was just thinking there, and obviously it's an area that we as a podcast and, you know, Mike, our community, have looked at an awful lot. And one of the things I've kind of, I'm conscious of is that often there's models of intervention, but there's very, so things like nonviolent resistance, solution focused, kind of those models of intervention. And there's smatterings of them, but there's very few organizations that sort of say, this is what we do. This is our sole intent. You're one of maybe two or three across the country.
I think there's PEGS that are base that sort of started around about the same time that CAPA did. There's CAPA, and I think that's a family-based solutions, but they don't just deal with child-parent violence. So I think there's maybe one or two of us.
And is there a HALO, I think? Right. The bell? I don't know, that's maybe. So, I mean, we're talking across a nation. That's pretty... And you're all relatively geographically based in areas and I suppose hoping to broaden out. Can I ask then a question? No, Scott is not here, but Scott had a very full and frank exchange with me before he came on. He said, I can't come on. And he said, my blood pressure will get too high. He said, can you have a conversation about the word, what CAPA stands for? You tell me what CAPA stands for and we can talk about the A word.
Let's talk about the A word. It's really difficult, isn't it? Well, not difficult. It's a tricky one, I think. So CAPA stands for child or adolescent to parent abuse. And can I just say parent in this instance is any adult with parental responsibility for a child. So it's abuse, child or adolescent to parent abuse. The A word, adolescent or abuse.
Right. So. I'm not going to quote him from his text because that would be unfair. We would all be able to mock him for his grammar. I think does that reflect me coming from a social care perspective that word abuse comes loaded with so many things around intent. It speaks of power dynamics. It speaks to all sort of things that we don't, and we usually do not associate with children. Is it, why put the word in there? Is that something that, you know, you make sense of that for me? Because again, I know you've perhaps come from a different paradigm, a different professional slant. I don't know.
You know, it's a really interesting one that I think for me is evolving and has evolved in the 10 years that I've specifically worked with child to parent abuse. I worked with a parent in the last year who said to me that I really struggled to get on board of getting in touch with you because of the word abuse. And I just couldn't connect the dots with that behavior and my child being abusive. Yeah. But she said, after working with you and talking to you, what I realized is that that's how it made me feel. I felt I was being abused. And so I could get my head around it. And for me, that really struck a chord because I think it's about a feeling that it makes you feel. Now, for some parents, they won't connect with abuse. And I totally get that. And I think what, again, I find really interesting is power, control and intent and how they all sit in the work that I do. I know, how long have we got? How does that all sit in the work that we do? And for me, I think one of the things is it's trying to help us understand what this behavior is and what it isn't. Because so many times I talk to people. Firstly, I talked to somebody just this week and I told them what I did. And they were like, oh, God, that must be really hard for children to phone up your network or your service and talk about how their parents are abusing them. And I was like, no. It's a child who abuses a parent. And they were like, what? Well, I've never heard of it before. Yeah. So, you know, we're going back to that, not hearing about it and being, you know, under the radar. So then we start thinking about, okay, if we say abuse to somebody who doesn't know about abuse, you know, who's not intimately involved in it, does that help explain what the behaviors are? And how does that feel for somebody who is impacted directly by it? Do we take ownership of that? But I think one of the things that I always, you know, consider, I'm going to talk to a child and a young person about their behavior. And what is it I want to say to them about their behavior? Do I want to say to you, listen, the behavior you're using is considered abuse? And for many cases, it is. So again, age comes into it. Intent are all really powerful things for us to consider. I think it's a bit criminal justice-y, isn't it? It's a bit like domestic violence and abuse. It's kind of born from that same area. And then that comes down to, should child-to-parent violence and abuse sit in domestic abuse organizations or not? You know, it comes, there's so many layers to it, Al. I'd be really interested to hear what people think about it, because I'm reliant on my community. I haven't invented the word abuse. So it's...
No. To my mind, I think you touched on a few things that make perfect sense to me, is that it comes from a community or a professional sort of paradigm where that is just a technical description of behavior. And so it's sort of removed. It is just, if someone behaves like this way, it's abusive. But I often think, and I was in a meeting this week, and I think you were in the meeting as well, so we can speak frankly about that, where I came away really conscious. So it's lots of different people who have a very, very knowledgeable and very influential people within this world. And what I came away really thinking was, I'm not sure we're talking about the same phenomena. We're talking about the same behavior, but not the same root. That in some ways we're all talking, you know, when we talk about intent, which is part of how we define it. For some children, there's a clear intent. They wake up in the morning and go, I want a new Xbox game. That's a gross stereotype, but you know, I want a new Xbox game, therefore I know what to do. I'm going to use my physical size, force, verbal aggression till I get what I want. There's another cohort of children who that's just not on their radar. They're, you know, perhaps because of, you know, how they're wired, their early responsiveness, their, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And so there is no intent, or is there?
And that's where I agree with you. And I think intent is you know, I often say to parents, so many of the children that we are supporting and the families we're supporting, they don't wake up in the morning saying, thinking, right, I'm going to be a real belligerent so-and-so this morning to my mum. I'm going to wake up and I'm going to make their life really miserable today. For most children, as we know, like you say, the cohort of children predominantly, And not everybody, but for so many of the parents and families I talk to, that root cause and that intent isn't there. There's a trauma, or there's a root cause. There's a bullying. There's a loss. There's a grief. There's some kind of root cause to the symptomatic behavior that's being displayed. And we all like to talk about the symptomatic behavior because it's easy for us to see. But it's this, you know, it's not that waking up in the morning and saying, right, how can I flex my muscles today and get the Xbox game I want, or the new pair of sneakers or shoes that I want? You know, and I've worked with kids that, you know, they demand new phones, new shoes, new this, new that. Again, when you start scratching the surface, why? What's that about? So, intent doesn't across all those cohorts of kids. So, again, you can't be blanket about it all. And I do think it derives, going back to where we started, it does derive from, it makes life easier for us to call it abusive behavior. And I go back to that parent and thinking about how it felt for her. And that feeling for her that said, yeah, you know, I do feel like my parenting is being abused, and I'm feeling my confidence is gone. My self-esteem is low. You know, I feel helpless. I feel hopeless. And that's a feeling. And how do you say to somebody that feeling is this behavior, and therefore we're going to put a blanket, you know, and I think that's why we struggle with terminology, Al, is because how do we put a blanket word on that feeling for parents?
It is really, in some ways, it does feel like we are arguing over how many angels can stand on the head of a pin. I do worry that it becomes like a slightly obsessive thing, that because I feel like I'm constantly talking about it, and I think I don't want to talk about it, but I feel compelled, when actually the reality is families are just struggling and we need to help. That's the crux of it. But my concern in the midst of all that is that there are families that come forward for help, and there are families that will not come forward for help. And if if the language we use is a barrier, then that's a barrier we potentially can remove.
But just picking up on something, like that. I think, like you say about how many angels can sit on a pinhead, and are we arguing over apples and pears? Not arguing, are we discussing apples and pears? And, you know, this discussion has been going on for the 10 years I've been involved in it. I don't see it's ending anytime soon. However, what really needs to happen is we need to start collecting the right data on this behavior. So if we don't have the right terminology for this behavior, how can we collect the right data on it, know what the numbers are, and therefore get the right support in place? So it's kind of a bit, we kind of have to agree on something, even if we don't all agree on it. Even if we agree it might be a bit clumsy or a bit crass and not connect with everybody. So maybe we can start collecting the right information about it, and therefore that will get support into place for families. You know, CAPVA seems to be the really sort of the one that's taking the lead at the moment, doesn't it? Which is Child or Adolescent Parent Violence and Abuse, CAPVA. That tends to be the, if we're in a horse race, that's the one nudging towards the winner's post at the moment, I think. So, yeah, I agree with you. I don't think it's about constantly bringing this up. We don't really want to, you know, but we do need to have something we can say this is what it is, I think, in order. So regardless of what people choose to use in their own organizations, what their taglines or strap lines are, so we can start collecting that right data. And that kind of has to happen, I think.
I mean, that is really an interesting point, isn't it? Because it feels like when people say, well, what is the prevalence? We don't have very firm answers. We can talk about in terms of prominent the adoption community, we can get some sort of certainty, but that's a relatively modest community with a high prevalence of early adversity as well, and trauma and separation and loss and all of that. One thing I was going to say, just in relation to the definition, I don't know whether you're familiar with what our colleagues across the Atlantic did in Canada. I don't know whether, you know, they literally refused to do anything until they got everyone in. I think they must have locked themselves in a room for about 3 years until they came up with a definition that there was representation from each profession. So I think the law enforcement, parents were there. Mental health, education, health. And they came up with the definition of aggression towards family and caregivers in childhood and adolescence.
Right.
Which is a mouthful.
Yeah.
Which is AFCAR, formerly CPVA.
So it's aggression towards a parent during adolescence.
But yeah. Well, family and caregivers.
Family and caregivers.
But I'll tell you what,
does it just say adolescence? Because then where do we go when we're talking about preteens?
No, it says, slowly because I did do that quickly. No, it's fine. It says aggression toward families / caregivers in childhood and adolescence.
Okay. Oh. And how has that been taken? How has that been responded to? Do you know?
Well, I think because everyone was around the table, everyone went, that was what they all came down to. I think everyone brought their own definition and then they shut the doors and who knows how they sorted it out.
My only thing that's going off for me is aggression, because it's not always aggressive, is it? Do you see? How many angels on a pinhead?
Yeah, I mean, aggression can take many forms, can't it? So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess we could do a whole hour's podcast and maybe return to exactly where
absolutely.
We started.
Absolutely, I think we would.
Yeah,
and I think that's why we struggle to have these conversations, you know, because it's cyclical and keeps going around. We're all sort of saying the same thing, and we all know that we're dealing with the same issues. And the terminology becomes a bit like you said to me, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, I don't think you will. You were talking about battered, and up north we talk about being battered, and down south we don't. So does it become, how are we interpreting it no matter just where we are, even in the country?
Yeah, absolutely. And within different communities as well. So you may be looking at me from a, you know, an adoption community, which is probably a very nice middle class, generally nice white middle class cohort, who take objection with the word abuse, whereas maybe other communities don't.
And I'm aware it's a barrier to some people. I'm absolutely aware. And I'm really mindful that, you know, that is, you know, that's the title of my organization. But, you know, it's for me, I'm really clear that I hate labels. I'm really staunchly against labels for lots of different reasons. And I refuse to label families, and I refuse to label young people, and I refuse to label children. I think there are times when labels can, you know, and I'm talking in the context of child and adolescent to parent abuse. So let's be really clear about that with labels, you know, and we talk about, you know, an abuser or a perpetrator or an alleged perpetrator. Now, when we start labeling these behaviors, that's the bit I think I'm uncomfortable with. You know, these are people's children who are, for the vast majority of families and vast majorities of those children, and they are children in most sense, and they are your child. You know, it's deeply emotive. And for me to label their child anything but their child is incredible, in my mind, not helpful. Recognizing the behavior and the cause behind it is really helpful. But start labeling this behavior this or this behavior that, I'm really mindful of not going down that road, because everybody has their own opinion. It's subjective. And I'm not in your family. I can give you my opinion, and I can give you my support and my knowledge and my experience, but I'm not living your life and walking in your footsteps. You know, I've walked my own footsteps and lived my own life. And you know, what I bring to my work is based on my, you know, my whole life, so to speak. So I don't like being labeled anything. I hate it if anybody calls me a label that I'm not comfortable with. I instantly, I disengage. I don't want somebody to put a label on me. So I think that's why I use that respectful way with every family as individual. Every family has their own individual experiences that's subjective to them. And it's that what we work with, and that's what we support.
I mean, that's really interesting, because I feel very uncomfortable likewise with sort of that you are the victim, you are the perpetrator, that very binary language. Because my experience is that once you get into the complexity of the behavior, you find that those lines get sometimes are a bit blurred, especially when children are vulnerable. And adults are vulnerable when people are operating out of living in a traumatic environment or an environment with the high levels of agitation, that those lines become incredibly blurred, and actually just not helpful to sort of. And also, our people's perceptions, you know, are altered by their experience. So, you know, parents start to begin to see their children as really powerful. And that then compounds the issue, you know, and then children start to see themselves as really powerful, which then come, you know, and so there's all those complicated things.
But anyway, then it goes to where does it sit? You know, that's why I believe standalone organizations, this is exactly the right place for it, because then it's not sitting under the umbrella of domestic abuse per se, where actually there is very clear language around victims, survivors, perpetrators. You know, we're standing almost in a standalone place, which I think is a really, for me, that feels really important for the family. So they're not part of umbrella services where actually they may feel more uncomfortable being a part of those. So another reason to have a standalone organisation, in my opinion.
No, I think that there's real validity in there, because I think that one of my perceptions is that often children's social care, because of their job, they struggle to see it in the context of a parent who is vulnerable. And I think that's a paradigm that just doesn't fit. You know, it's like we don't have a box to tick in our forms for that one, where a parent is struggling because they are vulnerable.
I totally agree with you. And if I had an ideal world, you know, and when it comes to the world of child to parent abuse, we'd all be working and supporting each other as agencies, because this impacts such a vast areas of families' lives. I would never, you know, suggest that I'm going to come in and wave a magic wand and make all that go away. I'll come in and do my little bit, and I'm really keen, eager, and encourage multi-agency working, because I think we have to affect all those different layers. We can't just say, right, we're going to take the violence and abuse away from the home, but unless we look at those deeper root causes and get support over that, we're not really going to affect change for a long period of time. So, you know, this, although I'm sort of suggesting I'm a standalone, which I am, and I can, and I would continue to want to do that, I very much work collaboratively and work with other professionals, and we work together with families. We have network meetings together. You know, we're constant in communication to make sure that we're supporting the bit of the, you know, the bit of the puzzle that we can support a family with. And I think, again, that sort of leads to the model of isolation, which this behavior causes. It takes away that isolation. It opens it up and widens the community and widens the support for both the child, the siblings, and the parents themselves, which I think is really important. I wouldn't be so arrogant to think I'm going to come in and be the only person that can deal with it. You know, it's, I can do my bit to support. And that's, you know, really important.
So do you find yourself sitting in sort of an advocacy position for the family?
I try not to do advocacy, necessarily... if I'm honest. I know what you're saying.
Well, maybe I've expressed that incorrectly then. Maybe that you are sort of, you're chairing or coordinating those services to try and help the other services make sense of the situation.
So I do a bit of that. And the reason we do that is because of the lack of understanding around this behaviour. So other organisations will come in and say, we don't kind of really know what we're doing. We'll follow your lead. You tell us what to do and we'll do it. So I will often come up with a plan saying, right, this is the bit of work I'm going to do with the family and the young person. This is what I need you to follow up. And this is what I need you to take responsibility for. And I will share. I'm really keen on sharing. There is nothing I do that sits behind a folder that I will not share with anybody. You know, there is nothing I'm doing that I'm going to say, no, you can't have that information, or you can't, I'm not going to share that knowledge. Because actually, the more people that know this and the more people that can work with families, the more they can go out and work with other families. It's that domino effect. You know, it's that I want, you know, upskill as many people as we can to deal with this issue. So actually, you know, more families will get support and it'll become recognized more and more. So I do a lot of work with schools looking at, you know, for, you know, those first points of calls for families. How can a teacher recognize what's going on? You know, so it's all about empowering not only families, but the professionals as well.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds quite a unique sort of space you're inhabiting. And I mean, in a context of the sector where money's been stripped out of it. So how do you, if I can be blunt, how do you support the service? Where does the money come from?
Good question. You know, I've been really lucky that I've had some really fantastic main funders over the last couple of years with the police and National Lottery Community Fund. You know, some of our work is, it's on a sliding scale. You know, we use some of the adoption fund, depending on the family's background. But it's a sliding scale organization. So some families come and say, listen, I can't contribute anything. That's absolutely fine. You know, finances is not a barrier to getting a service from us. But there are families that can say, listen, I'm really happy to pay £20, £40, £60 for each session. We do a lot of training, agency training, which, you know, obviously brings in unrestricted funding, donations and funding. But it is really about sort of raising the awareness with organizations so we can get funding from the organizations to take, so they no longer doing the work. We can sit and do that work and support them to do it and take it in-house, but we get that funding to do those initial pieces of work. And it's like with every, and I think somebody was saying at the meeting on Monday, you know, and sadly, we are pitted against each other. You know, organisations, no matter where, whatever organisation applies for funding, whether it be a domestic abuse organisation, a child parent abuse organisation, a fundraiser for something, we are pitted against each other. And I think that's really unfortunate because, you know, it's recognising there's more than one high street bank on the high street for a reason. You know, it's about families having, being able to get the right support for them. That's really important in my mind. And it's about making sure that families have enough selection to get it right for them. Mm. And hopefully we'll continue to be funded, you know, in that way.
Yeah,
you know, that's the key, isn't it? People are recognizing it and wanting to fund this work.
Yeah, the resources are finite, but it seems like the need is infinite. So there's a couple of questions off the back of that then, really. One is, I know you're based exclusively online, which is that just a coincidence of when you kind of were born? But then the next question off the back of that really is, what model of intervention? That sounds like that's shop talk, isn't it? What models of intervention are you using? Is it solution focused? Is it NVR? Is it, what are you actually doing with the family?
It just happened. It was always going to be online and remote because I wanted to make sure that a family, no matter where they were, could contact us for support. So I always wanted it to be a remote service. It just so happened to coincide with the pandemic where everything went remote. And suddenly people were really comfortable working that way. So literally the first phone call we received or the first email I received was from a woman who was living up in Derbyshire in the Peak District. And she's like, I live in a little village and I can't access anything. So to know I can access you online. And I was like, yes, that's why we're doing it. That's the audience, but it's really for anybody, even if, they're living in very urban centres, but actually maybe they don't have a professional working with them because I haven't told anybody about it. It doesn't matter. Mm. You can still you can still get support from us. And I think the second element to that is what kind of methodology do I use? I've done all sorts of training in my 30 odd years of working with parents, but I was lucky enough to study at the Institute of Art and Therapeutic Education in London under Dr. Margot Sunderland, and I was able to work with Dan Hughes, Gary Landreth, Sue Jenner. So I take lots of different models. Social theory, attachment theory, solution focused, a bit of NVR from the Break for Change stuff that we did and we were involved with, some stuff through experience that, working with families has worked, that has been developed over time, lots of communication, Eric Burns, transactional analysis. There is nothing that I do that cannot be found out there. Because it's all trainings. Yeah. It's almost all this kind of knowledge that's been collected over 30 years. And this is what I think is really, helpful when it works with families. I was very much of, an intervention is really important and you've got to start at chapter one and finish at chapter 10. And something I discovered with working with families is sometimes they didn't need chapter two, but they really needed to focus on chapter three. So what I use is a toolkit based on lots of different theories that actually I have kind of condensed down into some resources that I work with other freelance practitioners that I work with. And I introduce that to families as and when it feels appropriate. Or there could be things that just come out of after I'm, as a triple P practitioner, that has popped into there for my triple P days. I thought, I think this will really work with you. The parent-child game theory with Sue Jenner is amazing about building attachment and healthy attachment. Eric Burns, transactional analysis and the ego states. And there's so many different things, Al, but I tried to condense it down. And what I found is there's about 20 odd things really that come from different pieces of work that fit this kind of issues going on with families that we can kind of work with, the drama triangle, Cartman's trauma triangle. Like I say, there is nothing iMessaging, it's all stuff.
That's really encouraging because I think that I've always been slightly nervous as a parent. I'm a parent, firstly. I'm always nervous of these sort of manualized models of we start on page one, when we go to page 10, and if everything isn't fixed by page 10, it's your fault. That's very reductive of me, but it's really encouraging to see that there's this element of toolkit, which I think is what I've discovered with families, is that you've got to make a good assessment. You've got to find out what's going on. And when people ask me, "Oh, what should I do?" I go, until I find out what's going on, I'm not saying anything, because there's a zillion different things that could be going on, and we need to know as much as we can before we start sort of throwing bright ideas into the pot.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think it's about, again, coming down to each family is individual. You know, I remember somebody saying to me once that, I would never, ever say that to a family. Oh my gosh, if somebody has said that to me, I think I would have run a mile from you. And I was like, well, you know, it's taking things in context, and it's sort of saying, well, hold on a second. I said that to that family because it was something that was needed to be said. It was in the context of what was going on for that family, and it worked. Now, I wouldn't presume to say that to every family. You know, I have a thing, and God, again, this is another podcast in itself, to police or not to police is what I call it. And you know, there are some families I just won't even go near that concept with, because it's not appropriate. And with other families, it's absolutely appropriate. So, you know, there is not one shoe that fits all. And I take the families I work with, they're more experienced in their family than I will ever be. But what can I do to help support you work through this issue that makes it feel like you're not a rubbish parent and you have done something wrong and you went through a toolkit? I can't tell you how many parents have gone on 10 or 20 parenting programs and feel absolutely so exhausted and hopeless because the parenting program didn't fix it and it became their problem. I can't tell you how many families I come across that have done that. And it's like, I'm not here to make you feel worse. This is, you know, we're going to work through this together. You're the experts in your family. I'm just going to help support you a little bit and give you those skills. And generally, we've had, you know, incredibly good outcomes for families. That's what it's about. But families are individual. One shoe fits all. Some interventions are brilliant. Don't get me wrong. I work with Who's in Charge and Kathy and, you know, NVR. There's some brilliant interventions, respect. And I'm not suggesting that. And Break for Change, of course. But there are times when there needs to be that bespoke approach for families where it's not going 1 through 10. And you say, by the time you get for 10, well, it's not fixed. It's what's wrong.
And that's really interesting, because I think we've had lots of people come on, but you've kind of, I mean, there's a lot of technical stuff that you talked about, but I think it's really interesting to hear that you're collating all of this knowledge. And in some ways, there's nothing new under the sun, is there? When you scratch around a lot of these programs, it's just all stuff.
We're all absolutely. I hate reinventing the wheel. It's waste of everybody's time. I'm like, you know, it's already out there.
Yeah, but if it does work, you should maybe repackage it and sell it. I'll be your agent. It'll be great.
Well, wait for the book to come along. I'm waiting for the book deal. It's out there somewhere.
Yeah, I'm sure there'd be someone to take your hand off. Before we started, you kind of hinted about parent practitioners. Was that the phrase you used? Tell me how you feel about. Maybe I'm being a bit facetious and trying to draw you onto the rocks slightly, but because there's a lot. This is a really unusual landscape, isn't it? And maybe I'm asking the wrong question. So, right, do you have any worries about how the landscape is growing? Because we're still, there's lots of green shoots. Do you think that we're moving towards, are you optimistic? Are we moving towards a landscape where there is going to be more support for families, more effective support?
I think, like anything, one of the positive things about what's happening at the moment is there's more support out there for families. We're talking about it more. There's more available and more organisations are trying to upskill themselves. Brilliant. And I include myself in this. You know, where do you get credited in order to do this work? You know, and I know Respect are doing some work at the moment where they're looking at that accreditation, because families should know that if they contact somebody who say that we're going to help you with child-to-parent abuse, that actually there's some credible experience there. And I say credible experience. You know, there's a lot of talk. The buzzword at the moment is lived experience. And maybe that's why you're talking about parent practitioners. And, you know, I get that. I do absolutely get that. And I get why funders like that. I really do. But for me, credible experience is really, really important, whether that's lived or not. You know, if I, God forbid, needed an oncologist, do I need my oncologist to have had cancer? If I'm about to have heart surgery, do I need my heart surgeon to have had heart surgery? I want somebody who's got credible experience and knows what they're talking about. That to me is what's really important. And I think when you start getting people who said, well, I've done this because it's happened to me, you're taking that one experience and building on it. Right. And I'm not suggesting that's a bad thing, Al. I think it's about getting the balance right for me, because to have somebody who's walked in your shoes is really powerful and can be really helpful. I do harp back to, I've done a lot of peer support groups in the time I've been working with parents. And the one thing that always strikes me about peer support groups when peers are supporting peers is what, where that tends to sometimes go. So I think for me, that's the danger, making sure it continues to stay accredited and people, it's almost not like a kite mark, but almost like, yeah, there's credible experience here with this organization, and being really transparent about people's experience, whether it be credible experience or lived experience. It's got to be the right experience, and people will connect with the right practitioner. And people know if you know what you're talking about fairly quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And, I am sort of someone who's, that's my roots are in lived experience. But, and I think I totally agree that I'm always conscious that there's got to be more. I can entertain you for an hour and I can tell you anecdotal stories about my experience, but that isn't enough. My experience is exactly that. It's my experience. And that isn't transferable to you. We can, I can share, I can reflect and I can share, I can build empathy and compassion and all of those things. And I understand your experience, but that doesn't mean my solutions work for you. So I think that's Do you think we will get a kite mark?
I'm really interested in what Neil's doing at Respect. And I know Helen is supporting that work, Helen Bonick from Holes in the Wall. I think it's really important. I think it's a bit like, if you're going to set up a school or a nursery, you need to make sure people know what they're doing. We're accredited by the police, which is brilliant, by the Sussex police. I know that we've got the right people who almost sign us off. We've got Helen Bonick from Holes in the Walls as our patron. So, I'm not trying to be elitist about it. I just want to make sure people are protected, because there's a lot of stuff out there. It's like anything, isn't it? It's once people get on the bandwagon, all sorts of things happen and things spring up, and people promise that we're going to wave a magic wand and they're going to make things easier. And when you're feeling really helpless and hopeless, that's a really attractive offer. For me, it's just about getting it right. And again, I'm going to go back and make a full circle. For me, it's about children and young people are at the core of this. Yes, as our parents, but for me, children and young people need a voice in this behavior, and they do not need somebody out there sort of not protecting their voice and not listening to them and buying into what we hear so much of, I certainly hear so much of, is they just need more discipline. They just need a smack around the face, a clip around the ear.
Yeah, national service
is another one. And, we need, thank goodness we've come a long way from that, I hope, a long way. But, for me, it's about keeping that family and those siblings, that community is the family. And that is the core of the work that we need to be doing, in my opinion.
I really would like to come to your offices and see what you do, but there's nothing to see because it's all online.
Well, here's my office. Here you go. This is what I do.
Yeah.
I do have other freelance practitioners work with me that work in much more glamorous places than my little cupboard. But
you say you need a COVID bookshelf.
I am missing my bookshelf. I'm about to change all this over the summer. So when you come back, maybe I'll have a bookshelf.
Excellent. You need to put books on it like I have that I've not read. But look,
I've got a pile of them. Observer.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got like Bulby's first edition of Separation.
Oh, yeah.
Really exciting.
Oaklander's, Oaklander's work on attachment as well. It's all in my pile.
So Can you tell me then, Jane, where can people kind of connect into you if they feel that they want to connect into you or just find out a bit more about what you're doing? Can people literally just refer themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are on Facebook. So we are Supporting Family Crisis. So you can follow us on Facebook. We have a website, which is www.CAPAfirstresponse.org. And that's CAPA, C-A-P-A, first, F-I-R-S-T, and response, R-E-S-P-O-N-S-E, .org. So that's our website. And on our website, if you scroll down the first page and keep scrolling, you'll come across a little contact form, which you can fill that in and ping that off to us. And we're making this accessible to everybody. So you don't have to have a professional referral. You don't have to be involved with somebody. If you choose to be, that's absolutely fine. Professional can support you and refer yourself, but you can refer yourself. And the first thing that you will be offered is you'll fill out a behavior checklist, which helps us understand the behavior and helps you focus on the behavior. And you'll fill out a form about what you want from us. What are you hoping for? And what the behavior is. So it helps you think about that a little bit. And the first thing we do is we offer you a free 20-minute advice and support session. And that's really where we start to get to know each other, talk about what's happening at home. It's that first opportunity for you to say, this is what's happening. And we try to, you know, it's really interesting because I've been doing this work for a long time. And I work with a lot of different professionals. And, you know, in my previous work, I would take time to get to know a family and build up a relationship and get to know them and da-da-da. In 20 minutes, 99% of the time, I can tell you the root cause, you know, and put a strategy in place just because it's being really, you know, clear of why you're there. So generally, it's about giving somebody hope and saying, listen, this is what we think is going on here. Let's have a think about what that behavior could feel like. What's something maybe small we could put in place this week, even if it's just seeing it from your child's perspective of why they're using the behavior. You know, sometimes just that alone is like, oh my God, I never really thought about that. Okay, well, let me think about it from that perspective. We do a lot of pivoting. So, you know, drop us an email. You can email us at info@capafirstresponse.org if you don't want to go to the website. So it's info@capafirstresponse.org. Again, just drop us an email and say, hi, I could really do with some support and we'll do the rest. You know, it could be as simple as that, just a sentence.
That's smashing. And we'll put all those details into the notes on the podcast as well when it goes out.
And anybody who follows Twitter, have the wonderful Saba who works on our Twitter, does a lot of Twittering away for us.
Oh, she's been commenting on Facebook as well. She's been, she's been throwing a two-penneth into the
excellent.
The
she was a bit shy of coming forward today. She's like, no, I'll do, you know, she is our digital wizard, to be fair. And so you can follow us on Twitter at Kappa First Response, and that's first, the number one, ST response. And, you know, sort of that's follow fantastic. Our story on there a little bit, if you like.
Smashing. Well, you stay on the line and I'm going to turn off the webcast feed. But Jane, thank you so much for coming on. And it's been really interesting to kind of, I think you're probably the first person we've had on who's working kind of directly as an organization other than like individual practitioners. So thank you for your time and thank you for your honesty.
Thank you, Al. I've really enjoyed it.